Can't Say That is a sociology podcast that poses more questions than answers. Join your hosts, Drs. Nam McCarlin and Melanie White, in a journey to make the familiar unfamiliar.
Recording on Jacques Derrida. I'm Nam McCarlin.
And I'm Melanie White. And the reason this is take two is because our first take had Melanie moving around on a squeaky chair that corrupted our recording.
There was no way to salvage it. It was terrible.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Nama.
You under instruction to not move right now.
Indeed. And I was so petrified, I couldn't even move to record the right button, i.e. the red button.
Well, we said that we're talking about Derrida today. Do you want to...
Another one of these Ds. You figured out? You know, it's amazing when you think we've got... So far, we've had Durkheim. Oh, no. We've started out with Descartes. We've had Durkheim. Now we're coming back to Descartes, and we've got another player in the mix. I was thinking mixtape. I'm sorry, that's got to be edited. So just so that we don't forget, the D that we are introducing today is none other than Nam McCarlin's boyfriend, Jacques Derrida.
My favorite.
Favorite boyfriend?
Favorite boyfriend, sure.
Favorite boyfriend. have many boyfriends, but this
Jacques
one
Derrida,
has to be
Danny
your favorite.
Trejo, another D. Danny.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. It's a very good letter.
Yeah.
I think it's not my favorite letter, but it's a good one. We're starting today, we're starting with Descartes, but in fact what we're doing is looking at one of Derrida's readings of Descartes' work.
Maybe it would be a good idea just to introduce our listeners to who Derrida is.
Yeah, do you want to do that?
He was born in 1930 in Algeria to a Jewish family, and as a young student came to Paris and felt out of sync with Parisian student life, partly because he was from Algeria, he was Jewish, and that feeling of being betwixt and between actually ended up organizing most of his intellectual and emotional life, and many of his works, actually, in fact, we could say all of them are actually dedicated to that experience of being simultaneously me, myself, and not me, myself. So he has introduced a particular style of reading a text that he calls deconstruction. And that style of textual reading, he refutes that it's a reading. He refutes that it's actually a method. It is just a way. If I could do a nice French accent, it is just a way of reading a text. Lama, by the way, is cracking up. She has just split completely open because she's laughing so much.
You make a really good accent.
I don't know. I need some work. In any event, Derrida is influential in terms of developing this form of reading that looks at the conditions of the assumptions that formulate a text and seeking to expose those assumptions and revealing that, in fact, often the terms of undermining a particular author's argument are actually found within the very text that they have written.
That made him unpopular.
Indeed. Yeah, and I think that there's, you know, his personality is one of being able to celebrate being unpopular. There were some of us in high school whose names I won't recall, i.e. Melanie White, who did not celebrate, who was unpopular, but who did not have occasion to celebrate it.
But you did have occasion to see Derrida speak.
I did, actually, and that was amazing. He was speaking at Cornell University, and he was... it was in the early 2000s, so he died in 2004. And I remember feeling that experience of being almost like in a stadium, rock star experience. There were these security guards with a little curlicues walking around. Is the area clear? The eagle has landed. And lo and behold, Derrida would march in with this marvelous white bouffant hair. And I am here to speak about the text. and spoke about the text for a long time. And I don't even recall what the talk was on or if I followed it, but I remember so much the atmosphere of being in that room and of students and faculty, people just sort of hanging on his every word. And that was just a marvelous experience.
The cult of personality, but for philosophers. It's something that we don't really see today.
Mm.
I always show my students this photo of Derrida and BHL's Bernard-Henri Lévy at some conference, and they had this big fisticuffs outside. They were just having a go at each other. And just, can you imagine being so passionate about philosophy and your work that you would go and confront someone so physically? So I kind of like that small anecdote. I like that image too.
Mm. When I saw Derrida speak, he was also traveling with Hélène Cixous. Oh. And so she was there, and she was the opening act for Derrida. So it was a doubleheader.
Oh,
and she walked in this most amazingly beautiful tailored suit with this marvelous scarf, and she just looked the epitome of whatever one would assume Parisian style would be, and then of course was so incredibly smart and sophisticated, and I thought, oh, I want to be her.
I love her writing. I love her work and her readings of Derrida, and Derrida writing about Hélène Cixous. It's just, okay, we have our background on Derrida. Do we have any other gossip on him? He was a pants man.
A pants man?
Yeah.
What is a pants man?
A womanizer.
Oh, you mean he didn't just like trousers? I've never heard of that. These are the words I've heard. Womanizer, philanderer, as distinct from a philanthropist, but a philanderer. But I've never heard pants man.
That's something that I actually didn't know about him. That doesn't really show up in his official biographies.
No, but I suppose, you know, it's this, but we are European.
Yeah. Oh. The text that we're looking at today, or Derrida's interview, it's an interview that we're looking at today, was later on in his life. He was already battling cancer, so he had pancreatic cancer and passed away in 2004. We're looking at an interview that he had with, I don't remember her name actually.
Elizabeth Rudinesco.
Yes. We have Derrida, he is a very prolific writer, but his interviews give something of a different appreciation and understanding of his work. So his texts, his writing can be sometimes deliberately obtuse because he's engaging in an operation of textual analysis and critique that uses the very tools and conditions of the text that he's reading and critiquing. So his interviews can often give a different nature and understanding of his work and who he is. So that's why I like reading his interviews.
Well, I think it's the case that with an interviewer present, that you get that pushback in a way that if you are an author working a text and trying to expose the not me in the me of the text, that can become a fairly circumscribed and constrained occasion. But when you've got an interviewer there, an interlocutor that you have to respond to and that pushes you, it adds almost a third dimension to that relationship between author, text, and then interviewer. And that ends up opening up space where in some of the more polished, controlled philosophical exercises that Derrida partakes in, then it ends up becoming much more impenetrable to read that stuff rather than his interviews.
It's really funny. In Off Grammatology, I've read that book so many times. I need to read it for my PhD. And on like page 200 and something, he writes, I've implied it repeatedly. And I'm like, can you just state it obviously once? Like, that's all. We don't need to imply repeatedly. Just state obviously one time.
I've been planting the seeds throughout this. What? You haven't seen the seeds? Well, now let me tell you how the shrub has grown.
I think this is one of the ideas of Derrida that really grabbed me the most. Idea of displacing meaning, finding a presence in absence. So you can make meaning in these assumed contradictions. This is what he does when he reads someone's text. He uses the very foundations of that author's argument to critique and challenge the assumptions the author had made, that finding presence and meaning in absence, assumed absence. Mm. And I think that's just, and that dedication to reading as well, dedication to the method.
There's tremendous scholarship. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. And I mean, now actually, as I think about it, Derrida was someone who, and this is just anecdotally, because I can't remember actually what the source is, but I recall from somewhere, some text out there, that Derrida used to take caffeine pills and uppers and would sleep something like 4 hours a night. And just to be able to have that intensity of a heightened awareness in being able to read and get the work done. And so it accounts for this incredible volume of scholarship that he produced. But also, too, I mean, when one thinks about academic life, and presumably French academic life is no different from, you know, Australian or North American, where you have a multiplicity of different sorts of tasks, from teaching to your own research to administration, and then on top of it, you're a fancy-dancy scholar and being invited all over the world to speak. So, dude's got to take some uppers.
Oh my gosh. So the lesson, kids, is if you want to be a famous philosopher, just give up on sleep.
Give up on sleep and hone your skills of precision and judgment and exploit that great idea that you have.
Let's have a brief revision of the argument Descartes makes as a way of contextualizing Derrida's critique or Derrida's response. For Descartes, we've already established that being human is synonymous with selfhood. I think, therefore I am.
Descartes is wanting to figure out what are the foundations of knowledge. And so this is where he sits himself in his attic somewhere with the fire and his dressing gown.
What is
and
a
his
peignoir?
A peignoir, yes. Oh, yes, and his mules. His peignoir, his mules, looking at the fire and thinking, I am here, but I could be sleeping. And so this is the occasion through which he comes to discount or discredit his sensory appreciation of the world around him, because he could be dreaming, he could be sleeping. And it's that insight that allows him to make the claim that, you know, no matter what, even if I'm sleeping, even if I'm dreaming, even if some malevolent demon out there has manipulated the world such that I am somehow befuddled, I still exist to be befuddled and bewildered. And so that establishes the conditions for him to claim that the self is human.
The subsequent thinkers that we've looked at, then Durkheim, Marx, Freud, conceptualized selfhood as a process of becoming through different social contexts as well. For Durkheim, becoming selfhood was through a sociality, participating in society. For Marx, it was through labor. For Freud, we looked at civilization. But what all these do is they privilege some certain of the attributes of becoming self over others. So thinking, reason, was one of Descartes' forms of becoming self that he privileges over others. So and Marx, it was labor.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think one of the important things to think about with respect to Descartes is that these other thinkers emphasize the social interactional way in which sociality and civilization and laboring, that we work collectively together in order to create this reality, whatever it might be. But with Descartes, the difference is that there is a certain kind of singularity of experience that is expressed in this self. All we can know, and it's not even a we, all I can know, following Descartes' argument, is that I, Melanie, am an I. I don't know that you, Nama, are sitting here. I don't know for certain, beyond any shadow of a doubt. I do not know for sure that you are here with me. I could be dreaming. There could be a malevolent demon, etc.
Vapors of alcohol.
That's right. And so for Descartes then, and this is, I think, one of the important cornerstones that ends up subsequently establishing a baseline for modern philosophy, is the sense in which the individualization of selfhood becomes an idea that's tracked through these subsequent thinkers. But that individualization rests on a distinction between mind and body, that it is the mind of me, Melanie, that I can ascertain with a degree of confidence, but my body, etc., is secondary, because that it comprises the sensory apparatus that, according to Descartes, is something that is open to refutation, or not just simply refutation, but you cannot know for certain precisely because you could be dreaming.
It's, I guess, the problem of other minds, isn't it? I know that I have a mind, I have a self. How do I know that you have a self? How can I distinguish you, Melanie, from the chair that you're sitting on? If we're looking at the body in that way, is it not similar to being an object?
That's quite right. And so, philosophically speaking, the problem of other minds is, you know, not here in this context, it's not just simply the problem of other human minds, but how do you distinguish these material realities of one's bodies, one's fingers, hands, legs, torso, from the material that constitutes this chair, or another living being like an animal or a plant? What is it constitutively about the human mind that actually allows us to distinguish it? And so Descartes has some interesting answers.
What distinguishes humans from animals, humans from machines?
I guess I'm curious about this machine dimension, you know, because there's a certain sense in which a machine has a certain mobility or a movement to it.
And we should note that Descartes is also writing at a time where there's this big shift. So you have the printing press, you have all these things. So machinery, automation is something that Descartes is writing in a historical context.
It's just following, I suppose, from the time of Leonardo da Vinci, you know, that feeling of let's create machines, let's somehow transform and multiply human labor to make it more efficient and more effective. And so it's this kind of thinking that animates him in this text, Discourse on the Method, where he's trying to recall what it is that actually distinguishes human soulhood, human mind, from non-human, not non-human soul, not non-human mind, but just non-human. And so there's this marvelous line where he's accounting for the method that he undertook. And he says, I made special efforts to show that if any machines had the organs and outward shape of a monkey or some other animal that lacks reason, we should have no means of knowing that they did not possess entirely the same nature as these animals. In other words, you know, Descartes is thinking, okay, well, you know, if we had a live monkey right here, like some sort of nice capuchin monkey, and we had a machine, some sort of robot simulation of said monkey, really, we wouldn't be able to tell the difference between them. What criteria, in other words, would we use to tell them apart? One may be quite furry and seamless in terms of its joints, but isn't that just a question of better construction? They may both chirp, No, that's a bird, actually. Oh, dear. They may do monkey sounds. There we go. An appropriate monkey sound. They may move. They may enjoy bananas or other fruits, such as grape or kiwi. And they may exhibit all of these signs that we wouldn't be able to tell the difference between them. And so this is actually then framing Descartes' observation that really there is no difference between animals and machines, that they are in fact commensurate with one another.
So what happens if I bring the simulation of you, Melanie? How can I tell the difference?
You could ask her the secret question.
We need to think of a secret question.
So yeah, I know. How can you know? How can you know? What if, my goodness, there's, yeah. Well, this is the asking the secret question. And for, you know, for Descartes, the reality is that there is something that distinguishes me, Melanie, from that poor, impoverished simulation of a robot. A robot? The accent on the wrong syllable. That poor simulation of Melanie White cannot speak to be understood. Certainly, you could ask that robot some prefab formulation. How are you, Melanie? And that robot might say, I am fine, thank you. How are you? But the difference is, and this is from Descartes' perspective, the difference is, quote, they could never use words or put together other signs as we do in order to declare our thoughts to others. For we can certainly conceive of a machine, that Melbot, that this is that was inserted into the text. Descartes, incidentally, did not predict the appearance of a Melbot. We can certainly conceive of a machine so constructed that it utters words and even utters words which correspond to bodily actions causing a change in its organs. If you touch it in one spot, it asks you what you want of it.
I can think of...
I know. Oh, gosh, it's a bit... One never knows how into what subsequent generations and domains one's writings may go.
Nope.
And Descartes may never have thought about that. Yep. My goodness. Yep. Okay. So, yes, the secret question suddenly becomes the safe word. Oh, dear me. That being the case, Descartes will say, okay, look, you know, you can ask a robot anything. Are you hungry? Yes. Do you need to sleep? Yes.
We have Siri. Siri, Alexa.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. What is the capital of New South Wales? Oh, I'm Siri. I do not understand. Come back when you are ready. Oh, gosh. Siri is not, well, oh, no, that's Alexa. I'm mixing up my apps. Anyway, the point being for Descartes is that it is not conceivable that Siri, that Melbot, that Alexa could produce different arrangements of words so as to give an appropriately meaningful answer.
Words or other signs that we use to communicate and express what we are.
Yeah, exactly. And that this is all a function of sophisticated programming or sophisticated coding. And the human mind is such that for Descartes, it is impossible to actually replicate because we can cultivate meaningful reactions in ways that a robot cannot simply realize or even aspire to.
So is absence of language the only condition then for Descartes?
No, because the problem is that Siri and Alexa and that Melbot also exhibit an absence of reason. Now, I have a personal antipathy toward Alexa in my home, and I can verify without a doubt that she has an absence of reason. It is just absolutely infuriating. And even though she might do things, and I'm just paraphrasing Descartes here, even though she may do things as well as we do them or even better, that is, she can tell me immediately what 32 times 56 divided by 3 and the square root of 62, even though she can do that better quicker and faster than me, or even the Melbot. The problem is that she will inevitably fail in the most simple tasks, such as what is the weather today? That is a fact. And for Descartes, they would fail, which would reveal that they were acting not through an understanding, but only from the disposition of their organs. And by disposition of their organs here, he means that particular relationship or the programming or coding that makes those particular utterances possible. And the stress that he's placing on understanding is the capacity to appreciate the broader meaning of the world or to intuit why I might be asking, what is the weather, Alexa? What is it that I'm wanting to wear on a particular day? Where to another human, I might be able to say, oh, what's the weather today? And that person might be able to immediately know, that's actually not the question. No, you don't need to take your umbrella.
So this is the Cartesian legacy that we refer to when we consider what Derrida then comes in and responds to. It's not only this dualism between mind and body, it's also this distinction between our capacity for reason as humans and what non-humans then don't possess. Therefore, these are Descartes' very specific conditions. This is how I know that you are Melanie and not the Melbot, your soul, which is expressed through your capacity for reason and language. That is the essence of your human selfhood.
Yes. Yes, I was just thinking the essence of my human selfhood, and I thought, yes, it's all reduced there to language and to reason.
But not for Derrida.
This is, you know, strangely affirming, because I think I thought, oh my God, is that it? Am I just reduced to language, etc.? But you're right. Derrida has a different answer.
Yes, he does.
Tell me what Derrida has to say.
Well, as a philosopher, he looks at Descartes' philosophical heritage and influence. So Descartes represents this very particular mode of thinking that has informed Western philosophy to Derrida's day. And Derrida, as an avid reader of philosophy, a philosopher in training, is identifying these points of dualisms that appear in Descartes' work and in subsequent works. And in fact, these dualisms have shaped the way that we think and approach the world. So mind-body, human-animal. And Derrida identifies something very interesting, that these dualisms really privilege one element over another. They're not equal in that sense. Mind over body, for Descartes, the mind is the most privileged element. Human and the animal, for Descartes, the human is the most privileged element. Similar with, you know, Durkheim, society, individual. It's society that he holds to be of most value. So there's an imbalance there.
I'm thinking about other dualisms then, male-female. So historically and practically, the experience, male experience, has been privileged or held primary over female experience. Good versus evil, that good is a value to which, value that is privileged over evil.
This is the problem for Derrida then. He's thinking of the Cartesian legacy and how it comes to determine modernity. There's a few problems here. Firstly, it's the idea of the animal as this concept, that there is only the animal, that it doesn't account for diversity in species and experiences. So human and the animal. Which animal are we talking about? Is it the cat or the bacteria or the virus?
Or the walrus?
Chinchilla?
Well, it's fascinating,
rats?
Isn't it? Like, you know, when we think about the category of the human, there is a sense in which we have begun to appreciate the diversity of human experiences and human relations. But it's interesting where we, and this is a sign of our human privilege, to be able to advance a sense of a diversity of human realities. And yet, when we talk about other living beings, they become lumped together under this broad capital A umbrella term, animal. And so we might see...
And that's one of those dualisms where one is privileged over the other experiences.
Yeah, so it's fascinating because it's an expression of our human capacity to actually declare our privilege that Derrida has identified vis-a-vis this legacy given to us by Descartes, because it's the fact that we as human beings who have language or reason, these are our presumed attributes, that we can declare the very fact of having language or reason as the singular distinguishing attribute that would distinguish us from other non-humans, and specifically non-human animals.
But we've used these conditions, we've used these approaches to effectively justify our treatment of animals, of non-human animals. And this is the problem. Even the conceptions of stuff like law, like justice, human rights, the very foundations of politics and democracy or the world that we live in are founded in this distinction between human and non-human.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think that one of the qualities of Derrida's work here is that he's making not only a philosophical argument, and the philosophical argument is one of questioning what are the terms of this opposition that drive this distinction between human and animal. And so that philosophical part of the question that he's wanting to pose is to interrogate what is this animal that we seem to lump together if we, it's basically the philosophical kitchen sink, right? We put every living thing into that kitchen sink in order then to prioritize and privilege our human exceptionalism. So that's the philosophical project, is to interrogate, and he calls it to raise the category of the animal to a question. What is the animal? And there is, as you've suggested, then this political, ethical project, which is then to interrogate, well, what are the consequences of this human capacity to take the privilege and to assert that privilege over and above other living beings? And what does that mean for our responsibility, our moral and ethical responsibility to other living beings once we have this awareness? Doesn't it actually transform our relationship to those living beings, those non-human animals?
Oh, it's really interesting because the animals, non-human animals, have then been defined by absence. Incapacity for reason, incapacity for language. And it's this absence that means that effectively they are lacking. In their very nature is to have absence and lack. And this inability is what allows us and justifies us in our human experience with capacity, with ability to justify this mass murder effectively. This is what Derrida is talking about, the murder of animals for consumption, to sacrifice, to wage war on animals.
And I think it's also fascinating. I mean, one of the things that comes to mind is that, you know, since I was a kid, there have always been these National Geographic shows that show how incredibly talented other life forms are in terms of the ingenuity with which they may use tools or the way in which they may fashion their material environments in order to create living conditions, and exhibiting what one would presume to be forms of language or, such
communication.
As communication or being able to exhibit mathematical genius, you know, the mice that can actually do preliminary maths or etc. And yet we know this. So we have inculcated this. We are aware that non-human animals have these particular capacities. And yet it is instructive to me, and even, you know, day to day, that it is a habitual form of relation where I see an insect out in our yard and I say, oh, there's an animal, or, oh, what kind of animal is that? I guess what I'm trying to get to is that there's a habitual redeployment of this opposition inspired by Descartes, of this human-animal opposition in our daily language that reveals something, despite our best intents, of this kind of the implications of human privilege manifesting in our language and as a reflection of how we inadvertently, unconsciously treat non-human animals.
Yeah, because isn't then the question for Derrida, doesn't he ask, well, is the human not animal? Then how have we removed ourselves and have made all non-human animals a homogenous group?
Well, I think that's it. I mean, we move from the dualism human versus animal to, oh, hey, wait, human beings are animals, to then, oh, human animals versus non-human animals. But even in that non-human animals, that is still, it's a hegemonic grouping that doesn't achieve much more than a seeming solace to other living beings on this planet.
I think this has some serious implications then for how we consider ethics and how we consider our lives and justice, I think. I mean, the whole point of being able to have this limit or distinction between the human and non-human, for Derrida, it raises several questions. He refers to, like, the war on animals. He talks about slaughterhouses. He makes this bit of a controversial connection between the human Holocaust and animal Holocaust. Even in reading it, we think of how do we compare life, which life has more value.
It's the sense in which the power to declare privilege takes the form not only in a philosophical context about philosophical dualisms, mind versus body, but it's also in expressed practically and materially in the form of living beings who require sustenance in order to eat. That we as human beings have organized our societies such that we allocate huge stretches of land, hectares of land, for the purposes of animal grazing, if only to be able to use their milk, use their flesh,
for our own benefit,
not simply for our own nourishment, but also for our clothing, for our basic furniture, our comfort, etc. And so for Derrida, that there's that broader question of what is the kind of privilege that's taking place here? And as a French man who loves to eat, what French man does not love to eat?
Steak and cheese, I assume that's Derrida's diet.
Yeah, foie gras and what have you. That, of course, are functions of their historical culinary delights that are part of a particular heritage. And so this question of the animal then becomes a question of what do we eat? How do we eat? Is there some sort of ethical guidance that we as human beings should take on board in making those sorts of decisions? Now, Derrida is fascinating here because he does enjoy his meat, it would seem. In the interview, he says it's not just enough to stop eating meat in order to become a non-carnivore. This is because we are always already inculcated in a broad historical and technological infrastructure that is organized all around us for the production of animal lives for human benefit. And the production of animal lives is not just, you know, one or two goats, a scattering of chickens, but animal industries that have been marshaled and developed and created in order to supply human want and desire.
Derrida is really fascinating in that way. And you know that I'm now interested, my side research is into cannibalism. And I love the idea of having that opposition between the thing we can eat and the things we can't eat. So I'm just we won't need to go in that discussion. But I think that the example that I think of off the top of my head is the breastfeeding, that the essential life force for our young, for our children, is from our own bodies, from within. And so it is, in that sense, the justification of consumption, that what should we eat? At some point in our human consciousness, our human psyche becomes, we should not eat this anymore.
Well, it's that intersection, I think, between these categories of the sacred and the profane.
Yes.
In the way in which, at a certain point in time, nursing or breastfeeding one's young is appropriate for the first 6 weeks of one's life. I'm thinking about human life, 3 months, 6 months, a year. Then
two
it must
years.
Stop. Two
yeah,
years, 3 years.
Then people start giving you looks.
Indeed, you know that. How many times have I heard? Oh, once they start asking for it, then it's a problem.
I have never heard that. Oh, but yeah. It is so awful.
I know. People have views, and they always make me laugh. In any event, I think it's the layering of these different experiences of what is sacred and what is profane that, at a particular point in time, the maternal figure and the capacity to live life becomes sacred. But then you cross a line, and then that crossing a line, that designated time, not offered up by nature or what have you, but designated by some sort of external force, a sense of time's up, this is enough, becomes then that original distinction between what is sacred or profane morphs into yet another, and that opposition takes the form and gets strengthened by other already existing oppositions between what is appropriate or inappropriate, what the female form must look like, what the female form relative to male privilege must look like. You know, it's just that sense of strange ownership.
Yeah.
And about what ingestion is. Even the very thought of, you know, it's fine for an infant to nurse and to accept mother's milk. But the feeling of disgust that comes from, want a shot, is
of someone's breast milk.
Of someone's breast milk,
yeah.
Becomes a bit, you know, it's off-putting. But I guess
some people, even to watch it is off-putting, to be in the presence of a woman breastfeeding or someone breastfeeding is off-putting and perverse.
Well, and this is where that opposition between human and animal comes into effect, because there is, it seems to me, this privileging of the human insofar as that nursing is that breastfeeding is so animalistic that even though rationally we might know, yes, this is important for child development or infant development, etc., it's still uncomfortable and unpleasant, and partly that has something to do with the sexualization of women. It has to do with the sense of a certain kind of understanding about childhood development, and it has something to do with the intersection of a whole series of different sorts of power relations that get their strength from that kind of mind-body dualism.
So what should we eat?
Hummus.
that's a whole other episode. What Derrida presses on is that it isn't just one opposition or one binary of human and animal, or the animal and the human, is that it is... There isn't a single opposition. There is a multiplicity of experiences, of beings, of animals, and that is the key point that we should take away, in my view, from today.
Nama, I couldn't have said it better. That was fantastic. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the question, what do we eat, is a question that isn't just simply, what do we eat, but it obscures and all of these broader questions of, what do we eat? Do we eat animals? What do we eat? How do we treat animals if we do eat them? What is eating? Is it just simply nourishing our bodies, or is it nourishing our souls? What are our moral, ethical responsibilities? So I think, thinking ahead toward our next episode, you know, that idea of what is the nature of morality? I think human beings tend to, you know, there's been this long history that assumes that only human beings have the capacity to exercise moral judgment. And lo and behold, this question about moral judgment comes to intersect with the animal question as Derrida raises it, which is about, well, if we are operating under this kind of distinction between mind and body, this question of what is the animal actually intersects very nicely with the question of who has the capacity for morality, who has the capacity for empathy.
Now we can go get breakfast. Or lunch.
What will you eat? That's the question. I know it's a hard one.
Thank you to all our listeners for joining us once again. Thank you, Melanie, for a wonderful conversation.
Nama, looking right back at you. Thank you so much. And thank you to our listeners out there. Thank you, Kenya.
Oh, wait, we have dropped from number 4 in Kenya.
No.
Yeah,
where are we at?
Out of the charts.
Oh, no.
I know. Everyone, we must get back to number 4 on the charts in Kenya. Please subscribe and rate our podcast on any of your podcast catchers, because dropping out of the Kenya charts was a blow to us.
I don't know if you know this, our listeners out there, and maybe this will provide the important background, but Nama sent me an email that said, my goodness, Melanie, well, not really my goodness, but more, holy camoli, we're number 4 in Kenya. And I am so excited by that. And that just made my day and my week.
I think we're like number 700 now. Like, we're way out.
That sucks.
I know, it does suck. So please give us a rating, share us with your friends, and we hope you'll join us next time for another conversation.
Thank you so much, Nama. Have a great day, everyone.
You Can't Say That is a Carlin White collaboration. Francesca Rumi Cheng designed our logo. Our theme song is composed by Stephen Hart. Christian Fuertes is absolutely not hungry. Thank you all for joining us. And